I heard Lyndon B. Johnson was once given something with an interval, some information, and he was like, oh, ranges are for cattle. Give me a number.
Hi everyone, welcome to a new episode of Data Stories. My name is Enrico Bertini and I am a professor at New York University where I do research in data visualization.
Yeah, and I'm Moritz Stefana and I'm an independent designer of data visualizations. And actually I work as a self-employed truth and beauty operator out of my office here in the countryside in the beautiful north of Germany.
Yes, and on this podcast, we typically talk about data visualization, analysis, and generally the role that data plays in our lives. And usually we do that together with a guest we invite on the show.
Yeah, but before we start, just a quick note, as usual, our podcast is listener supported, so there are no ads. We used to have ads, but now the community actually finances this podcast. So if you find you enjoy the show or you're a frequent listener, please consider supporting us. You can do this with either recurring payments on patreon.com/datastories. So you can set up a certain amount that you will give us every time we publish a new episode. Or you can also send us one-time donations on paypal.me/datastories. And we always love when a new email comes in with a donation from somebody around the world. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, that's just perfect. And also thanks to everyone who is already participating and donating. That's great. Thanks so much. Before we start, I just wanted to briefly talk about the Information is Beautiful Awards. I think that's been a lot of fun. So Moritz won another award, but he couldn't really attend. So yeah. Me and Destry, our producer, went there because the event was organized in New York, and that was a lot of fun. So first of all, congratulations, Moritz.
Thanks. I was really happy to win. I just had one horse in the competition this time. It was my only project that was like would qualify. So I was quite nervous.
So they created a specific type kind of award for you, right, this year?
the Truth and Beauty Award, you mean?
How was it called?
No, it's called Unusual, which is like ambiguous for me to get an award in the unusual category. It sounds like could be a good thing or a bad thing, but I'll take it.
So, yeah.
But anyways, the awards, I think it's been the seventh or eighth year, and I think every year the quality has been rising of the like what is being handed in. And the long list is amazing already. The short list is actually all great works, like 50, 60, maybe 100 different projects, right? And definitely go to the website and check out all the shortlisted items, not just the winners, because there's lots of great, great data visualization work there. So I'm really happy these awards exist. I mean, even if I don't win, of course, I'm even happier when I win. But just to document what's happening in the field, it's a really great resource. So we'll put a link into the show notes, and you looked great on stage, like accepting my prize. So I think you did a good job of representing me. So,
yeah, that was a lot of fun. Okay, so let's start. Today we have we are talking about a very important general topic in visualization, which is uncertainty visualization. How do you visualize uncertainty? I know that a lot of people are interested in that. And it's a very hard topic, and there are quite a few people out there who are trying to make some progress in this direction. And I think today we got some of the best people out there. We have not one, but two professors. We have Jessica Hallman and Matthew Kay. Hi, Jessica and Matt.
Hey.
Hi.
So as usual, we ask our guests to introduce themselves. So if you can briefly tell us about what is your background and interests, and then we can dive right into the topic of today.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll start. I'm Jessica. I'm an assistant professor in computer science, but also in journalism at Northwestern University. Before this, I was at University of Washington in an information school, but I was kind of drawn to be both in CS and journalism. I care a lot about how data is presented in the public as well as in science. And so
my research is pretty focused on information visualization, but in the last few years, I've really spent most of my time thinking about how we can create visualizations and visualization tools that better support statistical reasoning. So things like how do we visualize uncertainty, but also things like how do we help people kind of become better at forming rational beliefs when they see data? So how are people sort of bringing expectations to data? Can we elicit those? Can we make them sort of better at reasoning? So one thing I wanted to mention is that this past fall, Matt and I started a lab together called the Midwest Uncertainty Collective, or MU Collective. So it's a cross-institution lab between Northwestern and Michigan, with us and our students, and we do a lot of collaborative work on uncertainty visualization and closely related topics.
I'm Matt Kay, so I'm an assistant professor in the School of Information at the University of Michigan, and I do work in human-computer interaction and information visualization, and I actually kind of came to information visualization via human-computer interaction. So I was doing work on personal health informatics, so trying to communicate things like sleep quality or possible factors that influence sleep quality to end users, and then realizing how difficult it was to do that. And that ended up involving a lot of things related to uncertainty and kind of then moved me in that direction. So now I do a fair amount of work in information visualization on communicating uncertainty and communicating statistical results in ways that people can understand, and now also kind of building tools to help people who are building models generate effective visualizations. So I did my PhD at the University of Washington, which is where I ended up doing some work with Jessica. And then now that I've moved here, we've started this cross-institutional lab, as Jessica said, which has actually been a lot of fun putting together and like seeing our students kind of also start to talk to each other and do things, which I think is really exciting.
I like the fact that you called it a collective.
Yeah, I think that was Matt's suggestion, actually.
Yeah, I don't know where that word came from.
Does it just sound good? Or
It just sounds cool, yeah. It makes us sound more cool. Like artists.
Yeah, well done.
Right.
It does.
Yeah.
It does sound cool.
Yeah, it's great. So the topic today, why we invited you is, yeah, also your, as you mentioned already, your main focus right now in research, and it's about visualizing uncertainty. So just to get started, what do we talk about when we talk about uncertainty visualization, Jessica?
So I would say we talk about something pretty narrow when we talk about uncertainty visualization among visualization researchers. So what we're usually talking about is visualizing error that's been calculated relative to some model. You could call it risk. A lot of people think of it as risk. But basically, you're making some sort of estimate. You're, you know, taking the average of something. You're predicting maybe average unemployment for next year. And you know that there's error, most commonly measurement error, sampling error, so random error. And so that form of error, random error, is usually what we're talking about. Sometimes, I mean, I've seen work in uncertainty visualization that looks a little bit at more systematic forms of error, like bias. But I would say for the most part, it's measurement error, it's random. So this is just kind of one definition of uncertainty or one form of uncertainty. There's a lot of work outside visualization, I would say, that talks about uncertainty in broader terms. There's things like ambiguity, there's things like, you know, missing data that sometimes come into what we talk about, but more often than not, I think we're using a pretty narrow notion of error. But maybe, I don't know if Matt has a different view. That's my sense.
Yeah, so I think that's true, and I think it's also in some ways kind of unfortunate. But I think that I would also say there's another slightly less narrow but also slightly less common framing, which is thinking about uncertainty in terms of probability. Right, so
yeah, that's like what I meant by risk, basically.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that it still ends up being narrow because you miss a lot of the more qualitative forms of uncertainty. But it, you know, you take error and think about it instead as the sampling distribution or a posterior distribution from a Bayesian model look like. But you're still essentially talking about the same idea, is just with more fidelity, right?
But isn't there a difference also between say, the uncertainty in how something is measured, because the instrument is doesn't really measure things precisely, and uncertainty coming from the fact that the reality itself is uncertain. I don't know if it makes a difference, but yeah.
I mean, I think one form that we don't often think about, that me and Matt have been talking about with another collaborator, Les Padilla, is something like you have a model and your model has a way of estimating measurement error, so random kind of error from sampling. But instead, you know that your model doesn't even include all the relevant data. So there's like you don't have all the factors you need and you know it. And so I think of it sometimes as like small world uncertainty. So my model is like the small world of my data set and what I know about it. Whereas often there's these sort of bigger world uncertainties where, you know, we know our model probably itself is missing things. So yeah, that kind of thing we don't often talk about in visualization, which I kind of agree with Matt. It's kind of unfortunate.
It's this idea of like model uncertainty or model specification uncertainty, right? Like you don't know if you have the right model.
There's always this tension in visualization, I think, because in data visualization, we like our data to be crisp and factual, right? And often like any method evaluation of what works well for visualizing a certain type of data assumes sort of, the data is crisp and factual. And then we just vary the different ways we can display it. But now if the data starts to be fuzzy to begin with, and so makes everybody a bit nervous then.
I think it makes sense. Yeah. The reason we probably focus on things like measurement error is it's very easy to think about visualization once you have that set of errors or whatever that you want to show. Once you have that distribution, it's just a data visualization problem on some level. And so I think that has made us focus on like what's easy to visualize.
Maybe stepping back a bit, why should we visualize uncertainty at all? I mean, we could also say we just show the best estimate that we have, right? And we show that in a nice and crisp way and maybe put an asterisk there and say like it's based on a model, which might be true or not. But so why is there a value in showing the nature of the uncertainty itself?
I think that at the base, simple answer to that question is just because you can allow people to make better decisions, right? So Jessica and I have done this work where we were looking at visualizing uncertainty in transit prediction. So this isn't like a huge high risk context, but I can at least say, okay, so you have, say, predictions for when a bus is going to show up at a bus stop. Well, we've run experiments showing that given better uncertainty visualizations, you can actually lead people to make better decisions, right? So you set up these sort of incentivized experiments where you give people payoffs for different outcomes, and then you can demonstrate that they actually make choices that lead to more optimal decisions. So I think that that's the simplest one, and I think that when you look at the proliferation of predictions and kind of machine learning kind of going out into the world, giving people most of the times just that best estimate, right? It has error associated with it. It has uncertainty associated with it. And we should be communicating that to people because it allows them to make better decisions.
I would agree with that. And just to add a few other cases, you know, besides like when you have model predictions, helping people make these like everyday choices, like, you know, what route do I take? There's also a lot kind of at the sort of societal level where, for policies to be created, they're often relying on, you know, different types of estimates that these government agencies are putting out. So, you know, should we do anything about gun control? Maybe there's analyses about that. But if we're not really showing uncertainty, which people have written about how even these government organizations putting out like GDP estimates, et cetera, often don't show uncertainty. We really like we're just as a society making bad decisions. And I think some of the other compelling use cases that include things like experimental science, which Matt and I have both thought about a lot. So, you know, if we're presenting results from experiments that we've run, there's a lot of uncertainty there. But if we don't really emphasize that, you know, further or subsequent researchers might think, you know, oh, I'm going to keep doing research on this thing because, yeah, you know, this weird treatment because they found an effect when, you know, in reality, a lot of, I think, what we're seeing with like experimental results from certain fields not replicating is probably because we're not really emphasizing or visualizing the uncertainty in a way that people are getting it. Mm-hmm. And then there's like, you know, other sort of life and death situations, like, you know, weather, like one of our collaborators here, Lace Padilla, works a lot on things like disasters. So when people have to make these like really important life or death decisions, like, should I evacuate if a hurricane's coming?
Sure.
Yeah, you know, like there's all sorts of reasons why you need the uncertainty there. But I think, yeah, there's also lots of rationales for why, like Moritz was bringing up, that we don't need it. And
I was playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I think that's the problem. Yeah. Maybe we can talk about that later or something, because I have lots of thoughts on that. But.
Yeah, I was wondering, I think maybe another aspect here is the fact that I think we already know from some experimental evidence that people tend to be persuaded quite a lot by numbers, right? So if you present something and you have some numbers attached, people tend to think that this is more, I don't know, credible, right? Mm-hmm. But then we have also the problem that most of the communication that you get from the media is that it's always without this uncertainty information, right? There is always median of something, right? And then people start debating about it as if that's the ultimate truth, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's a much, I don't know, broad also consequences.
The papers, they say the unemployment rate goes up 0.2%, right? But you never get the actual like error rate, which is probably 0.5 or something. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
and
totally.
Then it's a meaningless statement because who knows what's going on, right?
And you get these, I mean, as humans, we're kind of like aggressive dichotomizers, right? We love to put things into buckets and say, oh, this went up or it didn't go up, or, you know, there is an effect here and I can publish it, or there isn't an effect here and I can't publish it. I think a lot of what I think is important about uncertainty visualization is that if you do it well, you can try to prevent that dichotomania. Force people to confront uncertainty. And I think that's a lot of what we tried to do.
I have all sorts of thoughts about forcing people, because I think on some level, like, people, it's just really hard problem. Like, it's cognitively complex to be trying to reason with like two intervals rather than two points. Like, it's just hard. I think, I heard Lyndon B. Johnson was once given something with an interval, some information, and he was like, oh, ranges are for cattle. Give me a number. So I think that attitude is like, people just really don't want any sort of distribution because it's complicated. But so, Matt and I have done a lot of thinking about, you know, how do you kind of bring that information in a way that they end up taking it into account. And
Okay, but so let's say that we do want to visualize uncertainty, right? So now how do you do that? I think there's a very large space of solutions out there, and it's not totally clear to me what the state of the art is either. So I'm wondering if you can walk us through what exists already, what the options are.
Sure, yeah, I guess I'll start and Matt can follow up. So the way I think about it a little bit, or one kind of distinction would be, you could show the entire distribution at once. So you have some sort of distribution, you know, showing or representing your error. You could show that all at once in something like an interval, which is kind of a summary of the distribution. Or you could show, you know, something like even a histogram or a probability density function. And then on the other hand, and then there are other sort of, static plots you could use. Then on the other hand, you could show people kind of a set of draws from that distribution that you're trying to show them. kind of those two big buckets of techniques, I think, are very different. Like within the sort of first bucket, you're showing people the entire distribution at once. So that I mentioned things like intervals. Intervals themselves are complicated. So they could, I mean, Matt and I have talked a lot in our work about how, you know, things like confidence intervals are not usually interpreted correctly by people. So a confidence interval is describing like the sampling distribution. So it's trying to give you a sense of the error in whatever you're estimating a mean or whatever. But the way in which it's constructed is just very difficult to describe. It's using kind of frequentist processes that make people want to think that the confidence interval is actually the interval that's going to contain the true, you know, population mean 95% of the time, when in reality, that's not the right interpretation.
Oh, that's what I thought. Damn,
yeah,
it's
not. It's not. It's actually, it's the interval that if you constructed intervals in that way, 95% of the intervals would contain it. So it's, there's just weird misinterpretations. Yeah. On the other hand, you could have intervals that just, you know, are kind of more like a coverage interval. So 95% of the data itself, the actual observations will be in here.
Yeah. So,
yeah, Matt, go ahead.
I think this is actually, it's worth mentioning that this is a spot where we're talking about uncertainty that isn't necessarily error, right? When you start talking about coverage intervals or predictive intervals, right? So it can be useful to distinguish between maybe predictive uncertainty, or sometimes we make this distinction between aleatory and epistemic uncertainty, but I don't like terms like that because they're I don't know. I think statisticians often use words that are more complex than they need to be, right? So you might think of error as something about like the uncertainty in a parameter or a mean or some statistic you're estimating.
Let's say if I have like a temperature forecast for tomorrow, is that like what? And then we don't know if it's going to be 12, 13, or 14 degrees Celsius. What type of uncertainty would that be?
So I would think about that as predictive uncertainty. So you have a predicted, one way of setting it up is you have a model that gives you a predicted distribution of possible temperatures, right? And then you construct an interval by taking, say, like the central 95% of that predicted distribution. And I would call that a predictive interval in contrast to, and so you call that aleatory uncertainty. Aleatory comes from, think something Latin about rolling dice or gambling or something like that. right. So it's, you're taking another draw from some predicted distribution.
And the model will already give you like a full distribution, or maybe you let it run 1,000 times. And so you have 1,000 results and so on. And then the challenge is more, how can I summarize or visually present now this distribution?
Right, exactly. And this is where you also start getting into sort of philosophical debates. You know, are you fitting a Bayesian model? Are you fitting a frequentist model? Are you doing something else? You know, I tend to mostly just get annoyed by those philosophical debates, but
they exist.
Yeah, I think that like one important point, well, I think one thing that I feel or have seen people not do so well, we actually have a paper on it, with confidence intervals, I think it, in particular, is people don't really understand the relationship between like your sample and then the distribution. So your sample distribution, like your actual measurements, and then the distribution of whatever you're estimating, say a mean, which is much lower variance. So I think there's a lot of confusion even about like what's the underlying distribution we're talking about. The fact that we even have a model sometimes, I think people don't have a very clear sense of. And intervals, I think part of the problem with them is they're used across the board for all these things. You know, there's, and they look the same in all of these cases, whether they're 95% confidence interval or whether they're just showing you, you know, standard deviation, or whether they're showing you like a coverage interval, which is just the underlying data distribution, not a sampling distribution.
So what are other options?
Right. Yeah. So we can talk about, I guess, what we've been doing. We've been kind of focusing on a couple different, I would say, outcome-oriented or sample-based techniques. So rather than showing you some representation of your distribution, you're going to draw samples from it and show those. So the technique that I've been working on for a while is hypothetical outcome plots, where we're basically going to take the distribution and draw samples from it and then visualize those samples one at a time as frames in an animation, so that you're basically seeing the uncertainty kind of play out. You're not able to just focus on the whole distribution at once. It's kind of a way of, I think of it as more of a way of sort of forcing people to take into consideration the variance, because you're actually, if you're not going to actually add the mean as a mark to it, then all they can see is kind of the, draws from the distribution one at a time. They have to kind of use the visual system to kind of try to estimate like what the full distribution looks like. And so I think we've been doing some research on these, and there's certain reasons why once you move to this sampling paradigm where you're showing like samples drawn from a distribution one at a time, there are some benefits. Like if you're trying to show any sort of joint probabilities or multivariate probabilities, it becomes a lot clearer, or you're able to basically estimate those much better. So if you imagine like the typical thing would be like, you could show two bars in a bar chart. Like maybe somebody did a scientific experiment and they have two bars. One is like the control group and one is the treatment group in their study. And they put error bars on both of them. So you can see like the mean, you know, whatever blood pressure in the control, the mean blood pressure in the treatment, and the error in both of those estimates. It can be hard to answer certain questions about that data from a visualization that's showing you both distributions like that. So if I wanted to know, for instance, you know, if I ran this study again, what's the probability that I would still see a treatment effect that's larger than the control? It's really hard to answer basically from a static depiction, because it's that data is just not expressed. So if you were to show someone, you know, the same bar chart, but where the bars are changing height each frame in an animation, you can begin to estimate some of these multivariate probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, like the hypothetical outcome plot stuff, I think there's been a few cases in the media that maybe people would recognize. So things, like the New York Times has done, various types of election predictions, using where they're showing you actual animated samples of draws from a distribution. I think the most notorious one, which is kind of a conversation topic in itself, is the New York Times needle that they used on 2016 presidential election night.
Many people.
Right. Yeah. I know Matt has thoughts on this.
So, the thing about the needle is it forces people to confront uncertainty. I think this actually goes back to that question of, you know, why do we need to do uncertainty visualization in the first place? Well, a lot of people got anxious about the needle because they were forced to confront uncertainty in something that they actually cared about. And I think the thing about effective uncertainty visualization is when you do it well, you can make people anxious, but they should be anxious if it's something they care about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe let's explain briefly what it did. So it was the prediction of who will win the election 2016. And
it was a little confusing, actually. Yeah. Matt, do you want to explain it? Or?
Yeah. So, I ended up, I talked to Kevin Queeley, who, when I was at OpenViz, about how the thing worked, and also read a blog post that they wrote that I never saved the URL for, so I can never find it again. But basically the way that the thing works from my understanding is, so this was a live prediction of the difference in the vote margin between Hillary and Trump, right? As the returns were coming in. So as the returns are coming in, they're updating some model to predict this vote margin. The model generates a distribution describing their uncertainty in the margin, right? So the margin is some number between like negative 100 and positive 100, where zero means that they both get the same number of votes, right? And what it's doing is every 30 seconds, the model gets updated and it generates a new distribution describing the uncertainty that is, I believe, just summarized as a mean and a standard error or standard deviation, because it's predictive distribution. That's then being shoved into people's browsers, and then some JavaScript in the background is drawing samples from this distribution which makes a needle kind of jitter on this scale from, you know, Hillary wins to Trump wins, right?
Right, right. But the needle was jumping much faster than the data was updating.
Right.
So the needle did not reflect the data updates, but it reflected
the uncertainty.
Metaphor, more or less, or like a hypothetical outcome plot, basically.
Right. So it was a hypothetical outcome plot, and it was being updated every 30 seconds, and then also was jittering in between that to demonstrate the uncertainty. Although it was actually, the interesting thing about the needle is it wasn't jittering. It was actually not faithfully representing the uncertainty. It was actually not jittering enough. So it was only jittering in the central 50% interval. It should have actually been jittering a whole lot more, which is one of the things that I think is I don't particularly like about it. I do really like the needle, but I think there are things that I would change. One of them is that. The other one is exactly this other problem, which is something that we call a deterministic construal error, which is uncertainty visualizations where people misinterpret something that's representing as uncertainty as something that's representing something deterministic. In this case, thinking that the jitter was representing real-time updates, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a big part of the problem.
But you could also read it as sort of a faulty device. So I was thinking about, like, it's a sensor that doesn't quite work, or it's a machine that's under a lot of pressure and lots of steam, you know? And so, and I think in a way it gave a good metaphor to... okay, it's a very like a vivid process that goes in all kinds of directions, and we see like a shaky picture of that. So I think from that end, maybe it was a good metaphor overall.
I think it was a great metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the metaphor they're trying for, but I think
it was just
the problem
hard to
is some people
it.
Got that and some didn't.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. As it is with metaphors. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that one is kind of an. Perhaps a symptom, or the way that was received is perhaps a symptom of the fact that, you know, even leading up to the election, we weren't seeing things like that. Like if we'd seen the dial all along, and, you know, had been forced to think about the uncertainty in these predictions all along, maybe it wouldn't have been as big a deal. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have been, but, you know, the fact that we rarely see uncertainty in a way that we have to take it into account, I think is also, you know, a big part of the problem. There's kind of a norm to not show it, or to show it in a way that it's easy to just dichotomize. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think, like, you know, you would see these like predictions leading up to the election. You know, you could go to like whatever it was, the Upshot page, and it would just say, you know, there's like a 75% chance that Clinton's going to win, or it was even higher than that for a while. But I think it's the very notion of probability is hard. So, you know, people just want to round that up. You know, it was like, you know, it looks like Hillary Clinton's going to win because she has a reasonably higher than 50% chance. And so I think
it's
maybe
100% in people's mind, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that's why uncertainty visualization is like, it kind of needs to be a policy, but I think we're pretty far from that. So that people become better at just using it and more comfortable with it. So it's not like something like this gets rolled out and like half the people don't even seem to get that it's uncertainty, you know, like the deterministic construal error. I think that was what you were talking about, right, Matt? Like they think that's the actual latest prediction based, like poll results are coming in every second you know, 500 milliseconds.
Yeah, or whatever, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But let's talk more about techniques, because I think we all agree, okay, it should be visualized, but we also agree, okay, it depends a bit on the task. You need to be careful to hit the right metaphor. So what else is out there? What other things can people do to show uncertainty or make it accessible?
So
I mean, I think that, Matt was maybe should talk about this. The counterpoint to hypothetical outcome plots, like if you don't want to use, like if you think animated uncertainty is too much, like people are going to freak out the way they did for the dial, then there are other discrete outcome techniques.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a situation where animation just isn't possible.
Right,
right?
Feasible,
So there's two that I think I would mention. So one actually follows right from the election prediction example. So there was an interesting example of what we normally call something like an icon array, which is often used in medical risk communication. And the idea there is like you give a grid of say like 1,000 possible outcomes and you just color them or use little icons or something that, to indicate the different possible values, right? So maybe it's something like, you're looking at a Well, actually, I'll use the election example. So you might show a grid of 1,000 possible outcomes and color them one color. Well, let's say blue if Hillary wins and red if Trump wins, right? There was a nice example of this. There was a Washington Post article after the election showing probabilistic predictions from a couple of different poll aggregators. I think Huffington Post and The Upshot and 538, where they had predicted, like 538 had predicted maybe like a 80% chance, or maybe it was like a 75% chance that Hillary was going to win. And the other ones were more certain. So it was maybe like 90 and 95%, right? Well, if you look at that as a grid, they were actually doing it in a fancier version called a risk communication theater. So you look at it as like a seat map to a theater where I color some of the seats one color if Hillary's going to win, some of them another color if Trump's going to win. And then I say, I've given you a random ticket to a seat in the theater. if you end up in a red seat, Trump wins the election. But when you look at that kind of visualization, the 85% is no longer easy to round up to 100%. It actually looks fairly clear that there's a decent chance Trump will win. So
that's interesting.
Right? Yeah. And I think just that re-expression is one way of getting people to more easily understand uncertainty.
It's weird. Yeah.
I have the same with false positives. So I always have this hard time to understand conditional probabilities unless I see it. It's it's hard.
Yeah. Same for me. Yeah.
And that's where this idea comes from, really, this frequency framing or discrete outcome or however you call it. There was this research on Bayesian reasoning, so reasoning about conditional probability. And when you express things in this way, you can actually reason about conditional probability more easily, right? So I give you a chart, an icon array of possible outcomes of this procedure you're going to undergo to treat some problem, health problem you have. But then I can start doing things like, you know, coloring them differently depending on if you get a complication or something. And then you can start reasoning about, well, how many of these dots where the procedure is successful still have some complication, right? Which is a question of conditional probability that, you know, you could do with arithmetic, but is hard to do.
Good. Yeah.
I think also on the frequency framing, like that's kind of the motivation behind the techniques we've been developing, like hypothetical outcome plots and then some of the other discrete ones, this work in Bayesian reasoning. But I would add that there's kind of another distinction between the animated versions where you're seeing one draw at a time and the ones that aggregate. So like an icon array is showing you everything at once. There's been work, I think it's we still haven't really brought it into Viz talked about it explicitly, but there's work in JDM also talking about how there's a difference in experiencing distributional information yourself, kind of actually experiencing it versus having it described to you. So people tend to make decisions a bit differently based on whether something like probabilities are described versus experienced. And so I think there's a few kind of these underlying differences with some of the outcome-based stuff compared to kind of the more traditional, like showing you a density plot, showing you error bars. Yeah. So I think we're kind of still learning about them.
I'd like to move the discussion to more methods. Because we don't have terribly much time left as well, I think.
I was going to mention one other static approach that we've developed this idea of a quantile dot plot, which is basically an icon array, but for a continuous variable, right? So you're taking these possible outcomes and you're stacking them up on, say, like a number line. And it allows you to do similar sorts of things as with an icon array, but you can estimate things like intervals kind of arbitrarily, but it's more perceptually effective than like a density.
So it's sort of a mixture of a countable discrete representation and a distribution.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, best of both worlds potentially.
Yeah. I think there's one other technique worth mentioning like along the same lines as trying to force people to take into account the uncertainty. There are some interesting work on what's called value suppressing color palettes to show uncertainty. Matt might know the actual algorithm better than I do. I haven't read the paper in a while, but it's basically like you're trying to hide the colors. So if you know, color is representing value in some heat map type style visualization, you're actually going to mix gray with the colors when they're more uncertain so that your eye actually has a harder time of reading the value back from the color.
Yeah. That's something I also did, visualizing wind prediction data. And I had big debates with the scientists because they had 51 different models. And they were like, you cannot summarize them in a meaningful way. We have to show the full distribution. But I was fighting for showing the best guess and then using opacity to make it harder to read the ones that are more uncertain. And because we wanted to show a map, right? And so there was a limit of how much you can do at once, right? And so
maps are hard.
It's maybe not really reflecting the full distributions that well, you know, as the other techniques, but just making the more uncertain stuff harder to read. It's a very basic technique, but also one I think that
it's
can...
It's kind of smart, I think.
In some cases, do exactly the right job, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I think it can be good. The issue I had with value-suppressing uncertainty palettes is... I think that you need a principled way of deciding how much to suppress. And that's actually a hard problem. I think you can go to these kind of like models of how people perceive probabilities. There's this one model called the linear and log odds model. I'm not going to try to describe it right now, but basically there's some work in cognitive science that you might be able to take and say, oh, here's a principled way we could adjust probabilities. It's not something that anyone has done yet. It's something I'm interested in doing, but we, you know, haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, but maybe these techniques, also like using blur or using sketchy rendering, which some people do to make something more sketchy that is more uncertain, maybe more helpful for just indicating, oh, there's more uncertainty here and less over there.
Right. But I think,
you're really interested in the exact, you know, nature of the uncertainty, then
I think the task there matters a lot. Like sometimes all you want to say is like, these are kind of uncertain.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's totally fine.
But I think we default in visualization to thinking that, or the techniques we've used for a long time, you know, really only support that kind of task where you can kind of tell what's more uncertain and less uncertainty. But like when you're using these visual encodings that just aren't very effective, like hard to read, you know, you're kind of like throwing away information. Like if you have the full distribution and you're showing it in a way that people can only pick out three different levels of probability, then, you know, like it's, I don't know, to me, it goes against the whole reason for visualizing things. You want to actually allow people to, you know, draw inferences on that data that you have.
We've been discussing about alternative techniques, but ultimately, if you want to say that one technique is better than another in a certain context, you have to figure out how to evaluate them, right? Which sounds really complicated to me. So I'm wondering, I know that you've been doing some work in this space as well. So how do you actually know that one technique is better than another in one what type of context?
I think, so we've been talking about this. And I mean, I think there's kind of a distinction between how do we currently say that we know which visualization techniques are better and how should we? Like what evidence should we be looking for? And so, I mean, for context, we did a study where we looked at like about 90 papers that had published uncertainty visualization techniques and then done some sort of study to figure out which ones worked better. And what we found was that the vast majority are either just asking people to basically read data back, so asking them to report some probabilities that they saw in the visualization, and then scoring them on how accurate they are, how close are you to the true probability, so kind of like how well do people read the data. And then there were also a number of others that were asking people basically for some sort of self-reported kind of sense of how satisfied they were. So that might be like, how confident do you feel about your judgments looking at this visualization? Or, you know, how much do you like using this visualization? How helpful does this seem to you? So that was like the vast majority of what we saw was doing that. And I think there's problems with both of those. So I think the real hard problem, or the reasons why evaluation is so difficult with uncertainty visualization, is that, you know, people do want to avoid it. You know, we like there's kind of an obvious moral reason to show uncertainty because it's giving people more information and they can make more informed decisions. But the fact that people try to just evade uncertainty, so they try to round things up, makes it, I think, really hard to know if uncertainty is helping unless you're actually looking at how they make some sort of action or how they make some sort of decision where there's actual kind of incentives. So a lot of, I think, what we've seen in the study literature is just kind of looking at, well, when you ask people to read the data back, can they do it? And then do they like the feeling of this visualization? Like, does it seem helpful to them? And I think those are totally the wrong thing. And I guess not totally the wrong thing in that, like, uncertainty cognition is very complex. There are aspects of it that, of course, depend on whether you can read the probabilities. There are aspects of it that do depend on this kind of like affective or emotional reaction you have. But I think the really core stuff that Matt and I have been working on is, but still, I mean, we're still kind of early in it too, is just how do you actually set up experiments to test these things where you're looking at decision making under realistic conditions. So I think it's the uncertainty visualization evaluation is just fundamentally hard because uncertainty comprehension or cognition is fundamentally difficult even to understand, but also something that people avoid. So it's like, how do you tell when something's actually going to work in the real world, given that, you know, people might want to just look at the mean. And I feel like that's where we haven't evaluated much at all. So I'm sure
But
Matt
then it comes back to tasks, right? And I think that's a very interesting perspective to not just say we need to visualize uncertainty, because I think, it's the term is very broad, as we have seen. There's many types of uncertainty, and then people will want to do different types of things with it. And this is hard too, to figure out exactly what people want to do, but that will make it easier maybe then.
Right. Yeah.
End of the day. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I see all of those things, like perceptual aspects. They are, you know, necessary, but not sufficient. Right.
Exactly.
And the other way I kind of try to usually put it is, you know, just because you can demonstrate that someone can pull the probability out of a visualization doesn't mean that they know how to use it to make the right decision.
Right. Yeah.
And that's really the hard problem. And so, as Jessica said, I mean, we've been doing some incentivized decision making experiments, and I think that's where a lot of our work is kind of heading. Right. And I hope that a lot of other people's will as well.
It's been a hot topic. I mean, we mentioned it last year as one of the review as one of the hot topics of 2018, and that's, I have a feeling it's not gonna go away 2019 as well.
I hope not. I think sometimes it's hard to define the task. Like, as a designer, you're creating a visualization, and it's hard to know, like, or define what should people do if I show them the error information. And I think that's part of maybe why we don't see people using uncertainty or showing it as much as we might like, is just that it's, you know, it's rare that there's a very clear decision to be made from a visualization. Like, I think there often is a decision, but it can be hard to define. And sometimes what people should do with uncertainty is not clear. And that's why you need these kind of formal decision frameworks to think about it. So it's, I think it matters, but it's hard to sort of evaluate that way, or at least in like practice when you're designing something and you don't have the ability to run some controlled experiment.
I'm now curious about, isn't another aspect whether how people feel certain about something according after seeing different representations, right? I guess that's objective, but it's important, right? I think there are some things that people shouldn't feel too certain about.
Right.
And maybe they may feel certain just because the way this is represented doesn't take into account uncertainty, right?
Right. This is this sort of, like, you might do something like elicit subjective confidence in a decision or
something.
But if you don't show them the uncertainty, they might be really confident in a decision that is poor. Yeah.
Right. There's a weird relationship, I think, between what we like, or like what makes us feel good, and what's good for us.
Yes, right.
In this domain.
Yeah. We want to believe some things, right? And it's hard.
This is why I always get back to this idea of, you know, anxiety being proportional to uncertainty, right? If it's something you care about and you're uncertain about it, you know, sometimes you should feel bad.
Yeah.
Right. Which is weird for designers. Like,
yeah.
I think that's why there's this fundamental tension.
I'm wondering if we can conclude maybe by giving some practical advice to people who want to either learn more about visualizing uncertainty. As far as I can tell, there's no established, I would say, textbook, or even the material is very scattered.
Yeah.
And, so how do you actually learn all of these things? And then similarly to practitioners, how do they get a better sense of which tools they can use, which methods? I think this is, there's so much to do in this sense in mm. this space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I'm just trying to rack my brain.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, go ahead, Matt, you can start.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that has happened very recently, there's a visualization book that, I'm going to mispronounce it. Klaus Wilke. Yeah. I don't know.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. So he wrote a chapter in a visualization book that he's currently writing on uncertainty visualization that talks about a lot of the more modern techniques that we've, been talking about here.
Okay.
And I think that's probably one of the better references that exists. I had this ambitious plan of starting to write a book on uncertainty visualization, which is probably at some point still going to happen in my copious free time, but you know,
actually the grammar of graphics. I mean, I really liked the chapter on uncertainty in that book, which is kind of like a classic visualization book. It's a little researchy or scholarly, but I feel like the way the treatment of uncertainty is very clear in that book. On some level, just like reviewing just basic stats on like inferential stats is probably not what people want to do, but like the notion of a sample and a population and how you estimate and what sampling error is. I feel like if you know, maybe someone needs to create an accessible resource that's like three pages of like what you should know.
There's that seeing theory animated stats textbook thing, which is pretty good if you want the frequentist perspective on it. And I think I kind of tend to end up usually working in a Bayesian mode. If you want the Bayesian perspective on it, the first, I think, two chapters of Richard McElrath's Statistical Rethinking is another good resource, or he has some online lectures because it's designed as a class. So that's another place to go for that kind of basic idea of probability.
I was also gonna say Howard Wehner has written a few books that are kind of almost Tufte-esque. I don't know if you would appreciate that comparison, but they're kind of, they walk you through examples, and I think
lots of case studies,
much more accessible than some of the other stuff we're suggesting, although like the McElrath book I think is like really fun to read. I like to think that you don't have to care about stats, but I don't know for sure.
I guess another thing that I've been doing lately is I have a I end up often answering uncertainty visualization questions on Twitter, and my approach to that now has been to compile the various things that I've constructed into a repository on GitHub. So that's another possible resource for some of the, there's a lot of examples of like hops and some quantile dot plot stuff on there, and a few other even weirder things. I did one that was on uncertainty and correlation heat maps, which uses this kind of dithering technique for uncertainty, which is kind of cool and interesting.
Okay, so we're gonna add all these links in our show notes, so make sure to go to our blog post and check all these useful links. Thanks so much for all these good tips, and thanks so much for coming on the show. I think that's again, we could go on forever, I guess. It's such a complex and interesting topic. Thanks so much, Jessica and Matt, for coming on the show and explaining some of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, anytime. We'll come back.
Yeah. Love to be back.
For sure. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, a few last notes. This show is now completely crowdfunded, so you can support us by going on Patreon. That's patreon.com/datastories. And if you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show.
And here's also some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We're, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast, all in one word. And we also have a Slack channel where you can chat with us directly. And to sign up, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and there is a button at the bottom of the page.
And we also have an email newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox and be notified whenever we publish an episode, you can go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link you find at the bottom in the footer.
So one last thing we want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest a way to improve the show, or amazing people you want us to invite, or even projects you want us to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't hesitate to get in touch with us. It's always a great thing to hear from you. So see you next time, and thanks for listening to Data Stories.